Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For Uganda native Jackson Kaguri, the choice to help his country was simple. He saw his family and his community decimated by AIDS. He saw thousands of children becoming orphans overnight, living on nothing. So he took humble funding, got a shovel, and got digging. The result was a school for AIDS orphans. He's here to tell his remarkable story. This hour on Point, Jackson Kaguri and a school for his village. You can join the conversation. Has Africa and the AIDS epidemic fallen off the radar, out of the world's consciousness? Can one person really make a difference? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we'll remember humanitarian and 7'7" Sudanese NBA player Manute Bol. But first, joining me from New York City is Jackson Kaguri. He's the founder and director of Nyaka and Kukamba AIDS Orphan Schools in Uganda. His new book is called The Price of Stones, Building a School for My Village. And you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Jackson Kaguri, thank you for being with us.
Hey, Jen. Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate it. Before you tell us about your remarkable work building this school, stone by stone, give us a sense of your own history. Growing up on your family's small farm in southwestern Uganda, what was life like for you there?
Life was beautiful. Growing up in a tiny village far away from here, far away from Kampala, the capital city, Uganda, for some of the listeners who might not know where it is, in an East Africa country, landlocked, surrounded by Kenya, Tanzania, Democratic Republic of Congo. And Nyaka is right there in the corner, closer to Rwanda and Democratic Republic of Congo. To drive from Kampala, the capital city, to the village where I grew up, it takes you 9 hours on a bumpy road. And the more you get closer, and the more you leave Kampala, the more access to anything ends, and you are in the middle of nowhere, then you are in Nyaka. One of five. My parents had five of us. I'm the last born. Peasants who have never had a job and still today never had a job where they earn money. We grew our own food, lived in a two-roomed house. All five of us shared a bedroom with my sisters all growing up. My brother was the oldest and I was the youngest. And with parents like these who now have no job, they had to struggle to send me to school or send all of us to school. Education was paid for. You needed tuition, you needed uniform, you needed books and pencils. And for my parents to send us to school, they had to sell chicken, and chicken ran out. They sold goats, and goats ran out. They sold sheep, and sheep ran out. They went to cows. Cows ran out, Jen. Then they went on land. They are trying to educate children, knowing we are an investment who will come back and help them in their old age.
So your father was especially intent on you getting an education, and you excelled where you studied. You won a place at the National University in Uganda. You became then a visiting scholar at Columbia University in New York. How did you get from Uganda to New York?
Yeah, one other thing you had to do as a child going through education, even today, is to pass your exams every year. And my dad had said, since I wanted to start school at an early age, I needed to pass my exams, otherwise I would stop going to school. So when I was filling up this application to come to Columbia University, I had finished Makerere University, and while at Makerere, I had learned about human rights. A guest speaker had come and spoke about these human rights. And I saw Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and all human beings have a right to education and health and shelter. And I'm sitting there, Jen, thinking, my people in my village are not human beings. They don't have these rights. And so I wanted to do something about it. I worked with a human rights organization in Uganda, and when I got an application to selecting people to come to this program called Human Rights Advocates at Columbia University. I applied. Amongst all the practitioners and lawyers and experienced human rights advocates, I was selected among very few, the only one in East Africa that year.
So what was the response then after you had been selected by the human rights advocates and you had this idea of building a school? What was your response to that?
I came to Columbia University and met wonderful people. And I should tell you something quick. I landed at JFK Kennedy in a short-sleeved shirt on a January 16th, middle of winter. And a taxi man asked me, "Where's your coat, young man?" I said, "I don't have no coat." And he said, "You must go get a coat before I take you." The response was wonderful. While I'm at Columbia University enjoying this wonderful education, back home, my brother was dying of HIV and AIDS. And each time I called home, he would not answer the phone. So by the time I finished this program, young, skilled, energetic, looking forward to enjoy life, I went back to Uganda, and 2 weeks later, my brother died of HIV/AIDS in my hands. Mm-hmm. Married man, 3 children, wonderful, wonderful children, and all he kept telling me on his deathbed was, "Take care of my children." See, that time, wind had gone through sub-Saharan Africa, killing so many people between 15 and 49 years of age. People whose parents had worked so hard to invest in their lives so they can come back and take care of them were now dying at a fast rate and leaving millions of children as orphans with no one to take care of them. Mm. So as my brother died and I looked at my nieces and nephews and lines were forming at my parents' house with grandmothers asking me to give them a pencil that costs 2 cents or 1 cent, would end a dream for a child to go to school. And I would pass on these pencils, and I said to myself, I need to put up one-room school, put these kids in one school so they can have an uncle who cares for them, but they can also now have collectively pencils and uniforms and get an education.
Because explain the stigma that's attached to children, either with AIDS or those who have been orphaned due to the AIDS epidemic in Africa. What is that stigma?
You know, that stigma varies from country to country. Uganda is one of those lucky countries where the president came out so early and talked about HIV and AIDS, and education flourished through churches and through communities and schools. During the time my brother died, the stigma was even higher in 1996. No one would say they have it. They hid it because the moment people knew you have it, they thought once they sit in a room with you, they are going to have HIV/AIDS. Now in Uganda, it's not as bad as many other countries. Many of you and many of the listeners know that up to recently, South Africa had denied, including the president, Mbeki, had denied HIV/AIDS was not a problem. In many other countries, it is worse than Uganda, but still there is stigma. Our children do not face any stigma because they are orphans as a result of HIV/AIDS.
And so you took some money, a little seed money that you were going to use for a down payment on your first house. You'd just been married. And what did you do? You got a shovel? You just got to work.
Yes, growing up in this village, the saying that people use all the time that it takes a village to raise a child is still applicable today. People knew about me growing up where I grew up in a small village. They knew when we came back and would pass on these pencils. So whenever I came back from the United States and arrived in the village, lines formed still to come and greet you and hear these wonderful stories. And what I would do, I would grab the shovel, give it to the next neighbor and the next person, and we all go gathered and started digging the foundation. One brick by brick. The first donors were people in the village who made bricks with their hands and donated them to us. People who will never live in a brick house were donating bricks for our school. And people gathered. We took it on as a community project. They embraced it. And yes, $5,000 later, We had two rooms, two classrooms, and 56 students to begin with, brand new uniform. It was like a birthday times 56.
Now, do you remember that day that the Nyaka School, AIDS Orphan School, officially opened?
I remember that day because I cried so much. Cried because we are selecting 56 students out of 5,000 who deserved all to be in the school. I cried because I also saw children whose dreams were becoming true now, taking that first step, one child at a time, that we'll get an education, we'll break this cycle of deprivation and systematic poverty the rest of their lives, regardless what happens after they leave Nyaka.
How do you choose? How do you choose the children who come to your school? You say you have 56. You had 56 that first schoolroom out of 5,000. Who gets
yes,
to stay and who has to leave?
I'm glad I'm not the one who makes that choice. We have local leaders and local people, retired and local teachers, who sit in a management committee, and we take the poorest of the poor. How do you know who is poorer than the other? One of the criteria the management committee have told me several times, they will go and look at these orphans. Some, like my nieces and nephews, are orphans. Their dad died. But they have an uncle in Jackson who can help them. There's another one there who lives with an 85-year-old grandmother. That's the one we'll take before we take Jackson's nieces and nephews. Mm.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Nyaka School for AIDS Orphans in Uganda. It's a new holistic approach to teaching kids reading, writing, and all-around life skills. It's become a shining light in rural Uganda. With me this hour from New York City is Jackson Kaguri, founder and director of the Nyaka AIDS Orphan School in Uganda. His new book is The Price of Stones, Building a School for My Village. And joining me now from Kampala, Uganda, is Emma Mugisha. She helped design and build the Nyaka School, and she's worked closely with Jackson Kaguri to help raise funds for the school. Emma, great to have you here. Thanks for being with us.
Hi there, Jen. Great to be on air with you.
Why do you think the Nyaka School has been successful, and what is different about this school than others in Uganda, especially the public schools?
I think one of the big differences is that to start with, you don't have to have any money to come to the school. We provide everything for the children, from school books to school uniforms to the actual education to breakfast in the morning and lunch. And that makes a big difference from the public school, where those children were not able to go because the guardians couldn't afford that.
So is it based on that alone? I mean, is this a model that could work in the place where you are, Uganda's capital, Kampala? Would that be a model for a city of many more people, 1.4 million people, for example?
Actually, the schools are not in the city. They are 400, 500 kilometers outside of the city. And it's a model that works there because we don't just look at the children's education, but we're looking at getting clean water for the community, getting the whole community to improve their literacy levels through the public library, and looking after the caregivers, the grandmothers, and that support the children. So it's a more holistic model than just a school.
What has been your experience watching the children at the Nyaka School? How have you seen them change from the time they walk in the front door to the time they leave?
I think my best moment was about a month ago when we went. We took some visitors down to the school, and the drama club acted this play on family planning. Just the confidence that the children had, the ability to stand up and actually relay a complicated message in such a simple way, really brought a smile to my face, because these children came in very shy, very not confident at all, and not happy with their own situations, and therefore not able to communicate that confidently. And a few years down the line, 2-3 years in the school, that has completely changed. They're able to go beyond their circumstances and be able to also communicate to the rest of the community and things that they wouldn't be able to do before. So So that confidence, I think, just gives them the ability to be anything they want to be, really.
Jason Kaguri, how would you answer that question? I mean, these are the poorest of the poorest children in Africa. How have you seen them change and evolve and blossom at your school?
One straight answer, and thank you, Emma, for joining us from Uganda. One straight question, Jen. We got these poorest of the poor, the kids who would never have had a chance to get an education, and put them in an environment where we love and care for them, number one, make sure they get food, make sure they get health care, make sure girls get sanitary pads so they can stay in school instead of dropping out mm-hmm. when they start their periods. Mm-hmm. And in 2008, when our school graduated, our first class, Uganda public schools and system has this rate of 40% passing rate at national exams in primary school. Our children, Jen, 22 sat the exam, 21 passed it with a B+ and above. Mm. Mm. In 2009, as if that was not a miracle and hard, in 2009, 100%, 26 children sat this exam and 26 passed it. So you ask me what difference I see that difference there and then. I'll give you a quick example. One girl singing, talking about singing as therapy for them. They compose, they write poems, they use art as a form of therapy. And one girl was able to tell her story that her dad died. While her dad died, dad sold everything he ever had, they ever owned. And the wife never knew that dad had sold everything. She found out the day of the burial. Mm-hmm. While they are burying, that's when she found out, and she went in the bedroom, looked at three children and said, "What am I going to do with you now without anything? Take care of you." Went in the bed and hung herself dead. The first person to see the mom dead was her daughter. That daughter is at Nyaka. That daughter has graduated. She told that story in a song. She wrote a song about it, expressed it. We don't have therapy. We don't have social workers. But through music, she was able to be encouraged to tell her story. And now that her story is out, she sleeps better. No more nightmares about that hanging of her mom.
Mm. Let's get some of our callers into this conversation. To Danvers, Massachusetts first. Malaya is on the line. Welcome to the program. Hello.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would like to thank the two callers, the two people on the phone very much for what they do. I'm originally from Uganda, and I can't be any more proud of Ugandans hearing what they're doing, because I've been in the United States for the last over a decade, you know, and I always thought about something that we could give back to Uganda other than candy and gifts and things that are so materialistic. You give the kids something that they honestly can hold on, and that boosts their self-esteem, that that's going to take them above and beyond what they have right now. And I'm a fan, Facebook fan member of Nyaka Club, and I've been following it. And last year, we had, at my work, 2 years ago, we decided to start up something very similar. We talked to work colleagues, all Americans, and we formed what they call Father Christmas Project. And last year, we sent 8 people to Uganda and 21 suitcases. They volunteered for 10 days in various orphanages. Mm. And it was the most beautiful thing ever. And this year, we are hoping to take at least 15 in January. And we volunteer anywhere, and Nyaka School can invite us, and we definitely shall come in and do a day's work.
Hmm. That's a wonderful story, Malay. Thank you very much for calling. Jackson Kaguri, how much do you rely on volunteers, locally or internationally?
A lot. And in fact, I'm here jumping, saying, please come tomorrow. Please come tomorrow. Thank you, my brother. What we are doing here, we are throwing just a drop in an ocean. There is so much need. There are so many people who can come and help. Volunteers are encouraged to come We have a policy where we have volunteers come and spend one-on-one. We can come for Christmas. You can, yes, we encourage people to come, and I thank the caller for doing something about it. We could all sit down and fold our hands and cry about all this devastation going on, or we could just go and pass pencils and candy. But investing in a child's life is breaking a cycle of poverty in his life. And that's what we are doing, and that's what the Cora is doing also. We encourage anyone to get involved with us or start something using a model we've already created.
Mish is on the line now from Northfield, Vermont. Hi, Mish. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, I hope it's okay for me to say Dumbo, as I did when I worked in Africa in Rwanda about 35 years ago. I am very impressed and just thrilled to be hearing not only the speaker's wonderful work, but also some of the caller's work. And I wanted to raise an interesting question. In my experience in third world development, there's a tremendous danger from development organizations who enter a community and basically order people around and impose external values. What I'm hearing today is exactly, in my opinion, the way it ought to be, that is, local people using local values with support from the outside. And I wondered if your guest could address that issue, and I'll just listen.
That's a good point, Mish. Thank you very much. Let me turn to Emma Mugisha first. In Uganda, helped Jackson Kaguri build his school. How important is that to the caller's point, Emma?
I think that's very important because coming from the outside, you might identify needs that are not necessarily what is critical for the local people. So what we've done at Nyaka is, for example, the school is managed by local elders in the village. So the management committee is actually made up of local elders in the village, and they have a say on a lot of things that we do. They actually manage the recruitment of staff. They manage the discipline of the staff. They manage a lot of the. We will come up with plans, but they'll agree with us on what is right and what is wrong. So I think that is very important because then you're able to actually find out the real needs of the community as opposed to imposing what you see in other areas, so to say. And we've got two schools, and you'll find that actually the two areas also have differences. They may all be in Western Uganda, but they also have their unique differences. And therefore, the local community assists us in making sure that we meet the right needs.
Such an interesting point. Jackson Kaguri, let me turn back to you, because beyond the free education and the books and the uniforms and the food that you provide the children at the Nyaka AIDS Orphan School in Uganda, you provide many other extraordinary services and opportunities. You just completed a library, which was the first community library in Western Uganda. You have the clean, gravity-fed water system, which provides clean water to more than 20,000 people, including two other primary schools and a couple of churches. You've started the Nyaka Credit Program, which provides microloans for women caring for orphans in Nyaka. You have the Anti-AIDS Choir. I mean, the list goes on and on. But tell us about one of your fastest-growing projects, which is the Granny Project.
Yeah, allow me, Jen, to say jumbo and a barigani to Mish.
Okay, good.
I like the point he made, and that's what has made Nyaka a success.
Yes.
All the programs you just listed, none of them was my idea. Local people suggested and said, kids are coughing too much in the classroom. Why don't we hire a nurse? Said, go ahead. I live in East Lansing, Michigan. I travel back and forth to Uganda. And if you and I and Mish and Emma walked in our village and needed to select people, we would even select my own nieces and nephews as poor children when they have an uncle. But local people know their needs. They already know how to live by surviving in that environment. All they need from us is that assuring them we'll be there for you. Let us know how we can help you. We learn so much from them, and listening to them every time, I learn so much. The grandmothers, or grandmothers, Jen, this one is a wonderful, fast-growing program, and Mish will be interested to know, too, that as these children who live with grandmothers, You have to remember that these grandmothers raised their children. Their children died. That was their hope, for the children to grow up and take care of them. And now grandmothers are there without grieving time, burying more dead kids, and with more, some of them have 14 children who are living in a one-bedroom house with chicken and goats. But they still wake up and send these kids to school because we are providing it. So what we wanted to do is make sure the kids are supported home and at school. They get two meals at school, but we wanted to make sure that when they get home, they harvest something in our garden and go with that food at home, so grandmother doesn't have to spend a whole day working somewhere for two heads of cabbage and a pineapple and come home and she can't even sit and tell a story to their grandchildren. There are 7,000 grandmothers. They formed themselves in 91 groups, and all it takes to change a grandmother's life in this village, $20. You get $20 and buy a piglet, and that grandmother is taken care of. They buy a goat, and they get this money. You never have to invest in more money. They get interest and give it to each other, and they walk with their heads up through the village with chairperson and treasurer and secretary, and they are a strong group now that is making the community even flourish with this possibility that they had not envisioned would happen.
Here's another call from Rafine, Virginia. Anya is on the line. Hi, Anya. I appreciate you waiting. Glad you called. Hello.
Hi, and to your guest, I would like to say jumbo and habari gani. I'm an American nurse, and in October, I'm going to be moving to Zambia to work as a volunteer for 3 years at an HIV/AIDS clinic. And I just wanted to ask your guest what advice he has for me moving into that situation as I begin my work with the African people.
Anya, thank you. Jackson Kaguri?
Anya, thank you so much, and I really, really admire your courage to go and spend 3 years of your life serving people. The only advice I can give you is go there with an open mind. Know you will learn so much as you teach them so much. There are so many needs. You will sometimes be overwhelmed, but every day you touch someone's life, and you will touch many lives than you will ever even know. Emma, so go in with an open mind, and I thank you for even thinking about it to go serve these children.
Emma Mugisha, I have about 30 seconds left from Kampala, Uganda. What is your advice for the caller, Anya?
Well, I definitely say to go with an open mind, but also it's very simple things sometimes that make the difference. It may not be complicated medication. It could be simple things like antibiotics that will actually make the difference. I've lived with some people that have been HIV, and sometimes it's encouragement. It's just the positive word that makes the difference. So, yeah, I wish them well, and I hope that they have a good time in Zambia.
Emma Mugisha, I appreciate your time today. Emma helped design and build the Nyaka AIDS Orphan School, and she's worked closely with Jackson Kaguri to raise funds for the Nyaka AIDS Orphan School there. Emma, thank you so much for your efforts, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you, too, for having me.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about hope and making a difference in a small village in Uganda. With me now from New York City this hour, Jackson Kaguri, founder and director of the Nyaka AIDS Orphans School in Uganda. His new book is called The Price of Stones, Building a School for My Village. And you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Jackson, let me ask you about the Obama administration and its recent pledge of $63 billion over the next 6 years to fight health problems around the globe. The money is going to fight HIV and AIDS, but it's much less than expected. The administration recommends building fewer clinics, consolidating existing ones, limiting the number of new patients. How will this affect Uganda's fight against HIV/AIDS?
Jen, glad you brought up that point, because recently there was an article in the New York Times talking about clinics in Uganda that provide ARVs and medication, and these doctors have had already cut patients who are on this medication. $63 billion sounds so big, huge of an amount to be putting towards HIV AIDS. But when you also look at how much money we are spending on the war, it's far more than that. And when people are lining up to come to a clinic to get medication and they are turned away in the city, what that tells you, listeners, if it is cutting in the cities, this medication has never even reached in the villages. Nyaka is located in Kanungu district and Rukunjiri districts, where the children, the five children that are affected by HIV AIDS in our school, we buy medication for them. There's nowhere they can get it for free. The people in my village, about 250,000 people in this district, have only one doctor. One. In 1979, when I was 9 years old and fell out of a tree, a story that is in this book, I nearly died, we had one doctor. In 2010, there's still one doctor.
So not much has changed.
So this man is not going to do anything for the people in my village. The human rights, I studied and thought I was going to change and make a difference. We've made it one at a time. But those human rights of people getting medication and shelter and education is still far away dream for many.
So you've built this school, the Nyaka School for the AIDS Orphans in Uganda, brick by brick, classroom by classroom, and these children come and they study with you, you teach them. How long are they with you, and what happens to them when they leave?
It's an investment of at least 16 years. They come in at lowest level, which is primary one. At primary seven, they graduate primary. That's the graduation I was talking about earlier. These 7 years are 7 years of their best in life. In fact, one chapter I talk about in a book is a girl who was born with HIV AIDS and died 4 years ago. And she requested her grandmother that she wanted to be buried in her uniform, because the happiest moments in her life is when she was at Nyaka. So we changed their lives within those 7 years.
I remember that story of Scovia. It was just
Scovia, yeah. Yes.
Do you get attached to these children, and how do you manage your own emotions as you're trying to help them?
I cry a lot, so I shed a lot of tears. Even on book tour, I've been crying a lot. That's one way of... I miss them. I am attached to them. I have an 8-year-old son, Nicholas, and I tell people all the time, when I look at Nicholas, I can't imagine waking up next morning and I'm not there for him. So that's the way I treat these children. But when they graduate, we give them a $500 scholarship, which is $500 for a whole year for a child to go in a boarding secondary school. But after doing that for 2 years, our board and volunteers, and by the way, we would not be able to do all this in the United States and Canada and everywhere without the board and volunteers who help us every day.
Well, the stories in your book of these children, little Bruno, one of your star students who lives alone, he walks several miles a day to school, seven miles. The story of little Fiona, who can't believe there's going to be electricity at the school. She's so delighted that she'll be able to read at night.
Right.
Isadol declares that he wants to be a doctor someday. He wants to build a hospital and for maybe even a school like the one you built. These stories must bring incredible satisfaction and joy to you.
They do. I never go to sleep and I lose sleep. I'm able to go to sleep knowing that all these children get on their knees every day and pray for me, and pray for everybody who helps them. Knowing 7,000 grandmothers, those are 14,000 knees, getting on their knees and praying and for God to bless us and take care of us. I am a happy man. They give me so much more than I give them.
Here's another call from McMinnville, Tennessee. Olamida is on the line. Welcome to the program. Hello.
Hey, Hey, how are you doing? I just wanted to, again, say thank you for all the sacrifices that you've done. I have a personal story. My dad, he was born in Nigeria, and I was born there too. And, you know, he had a missionary that helped him and helped guide him and support him through education and everything else like that. So, you know, education is definitely the key to help these kids get out of poverty. A couple questions that I have for you are, one, how did you prevent corruption? Because corruption tends to be one of the things that prevents good ideas from becoming even bigger, from getting into the school and things of that nature. And the second question is, do you think you're more successful because you're working with children rather than adults? Mm. And I'll take my call off here.
Thank you so much, sir. Jackson Karugi.
Yes, Alameda, thank you so much for your question. Yes, education is the key. How did we avoid corruption? How do we avoid it? That's a very good question, because many people think the moment you give any money to any African charitable organization is going to end up in the hands of corrupt officials. Partly yes, partly no. Here you have a community that is doing this thing for themselves. The point we made earlier, where I live here, they handle this. The local people bought in. In fact, we've never lost a brick. We've never lost a stone. Hmm. Even in the book, it talks about when my own dad caught a man trying to steal a stone, and the whole village got to know about it. When I tried to register the school, government officials tried to get bribes, inspectors. And we told them, this is your school for the children in this community, for the people in this community, and if you mishandle it, the community will lose. So the community takes up arms and they protect it and they love it and they take care of it. Mm. That doesn't mean that people might be tempted to do something. We have a good accounting system and people understand anything happens, another community is waiting for an opportunity. Yeah,
they've taken ownership of it. And to the
exactly.
caller's second question, are you more successful, do you think, because you're working with children?
I think we are more successful because we are working in a unique situation which has no other opportunities. You have UNICEF and Save the Children, and everybody works in the city. Everybody wants the comfort of working where you have air conditioning and all this. We work in an environment that is abandoned. I took it up upon myself to start from there. Yes, we do have grandmothers, we do have adult water, but you might be right when I call you on your child, thinking of your own child, you might be more compelled to invest in a child because they have many, many more years to live and come back to take care of the community.
I know,
but
you.
The
work,
answer is,
I know, Jackson, you work full time now, mostly fundraising for your school in Uganda. How do you help people connect with Uganda and the struggles of the people there, especially the children that you serve in your school?
I always want people to understand that the situation we are talking about, number one, the story you hear, if you let people call for like 3 hours, you would hear it over and over and over. Every immigrant in this country has gone through what I've gone through. Many people still help in their homes. I'm just a voice for these kids, and being a vessel, talking about their stories, representing them. Working full-time for it is going to be wonderful, and many people who have had this program will tell more about it, and the book is actually there to expand what some of those people we cannot reach physically.
Well, you are an inspiration, Jackson Karugi. Thank you so much for your time, sir, your work, and for this wonderful book. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having me, Jen.
Jackson Kaguri's new book is The Price of Stones, Building a School for My Village. In a moment, remembering humanitarian and basketball player Manute Bol. This is On Point. Tomorrow, funeral services will be held at Washington's National Cathedral for Manute Bol. The former NBA basketball player and humanitarian passed away earlier this month. He was 47 years old. At 7 feet 7 inches tall and 225 pounds, he was the tallest and thinnest player in the league. a big chalk blocker, and with an even bigger heart, he never forgot his native Sudan. In a recent Wall Street Journal op-ed piece, John Shields, assistant professor of government at Claremont McKenna College, paid tribute to Bol. He joins me now from Claremont, California. Welcome to the program, Professor. Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
You wrote a very moving story about Manute Bol in the journal. He dedicated his life to humanitarian work in Africa. What was his contribution there?
Well, he started traveling to the Sudan back in the early 90s, and he gave most of his fortune, which is estimated to be about $6 million, to help refugees, to help children. He built schools there. He built churches. And then when his fortune dried up, he participated in all sorts of he really sort of made himself a sort of circus clown. I mean, quite literally. I mean, he agreed, for example, to participate in a sort of minor league hockey game, even though he had never been on skates before. He agreed to be the world's largest jockey, even though he had never ridden a horse. He agreed to box, participate in a celebrity boxing match with William the Refrigerator Perry, who is a former defensive lineman for the Chicago Bears. So he really made himself a sort of spectacle. And he did it simply to raise money for suffering children and families in the Sudan.
And how did he feel about doing that, and what was the response back home?
Well, he seemed to feel really called to do this. He had this very, he was driven by a sort of a very intense sort of a faith in Christianity. And he really believed that his life was a gift from God, and that it was his responsibility as a Christian to share his gifts with others, and not to hoard his treasures. And he was very well regarded back home. He was even asked to extend his last stay in the Sudan to sort of monitor the election to help prevent corruption, which may in fact have really contributed to his death, because he was really quite sick and needed to get back to the West to really treat his kidney condition.
And then what happened? He took some medication that actually made him sick.
He did, yeah. So he most of his friends will say that he his last trip to the Sudan is what killed him, because he was sick in America, and then should have stayed here and cleared up the condition, but he left for the Sudan, and then he extended his stay, and then he got very sick with a skin condition that apparently was so painful that he couldn't eat for 11 days. So he not only died on behalf of the Sudanese that he loved, but he also really suffered as well.
What is the work in the Sudan that continues to this day in Manute Bol's name?
Well, one of the big things he's done is he started a foundation called the Sudan Sunrise Foundation. He was a big believer in education, and so in fact, he was, until recently, he was there building schools in the southern Sudan. He hopes to build, I think, some 41 schools, and it was really a project that he was really just getting off the ground when he died, hopefully that work will continue now that he's passed away.
What do you see the lesson of Manute Bol? And I'm curious why you chose to write such a moving tribute in the Wall Street Journal about him.
Well, I was very taken with his story. I was a little bit troubled by some of the obituaries. The obituaries described him as humanitarian, but often not a Christian. And I think if you really want to honor him and really comprehend his life, I think that's really important, because you know, Christianity was just fundamental to his whole existence and life. It was constitutive of who he was. And so to not even mention it, it would be a little bit like, you know, writing an obituary for Liberace without mentioning that he was gay, right? I mean, this was just a sort of constitutive part of who he was, of his identity, of how he understood the world, of how he comprehended it. And so I thought it was really important to put, you know, to correct that narrative a little bit about his life.
Was he a sort of unique entity in the NBA, in the sports world, would you say?
Yeah, he certainly was. I mean, you know, the the NBA is, of course, it's marked by a lot of sort of rapacious sort of materialism, sort of celebrity culture. And so Manute Bol was sort of radically countercultural. You know, he was willing to sort of part with all his fortune and his money. And so that made him stand out all the more. Quite aside from his unusual size, he was just an unusually charitable person, he was quite remarkable.
Well, thank you very much for your insights today, John Shields. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Jane.
John's assistant professor of government at Claremont College, McKenna College, and you can link to his Wall Street Journal essay at our website. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.